Thursday, May 15th. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. We've seen the headlines recently. They are indeed troubling, whether they're out of D.C., whether they're out of Newark. Trouble in the air.
Yep.
Outdated technology, all sorts of delays, and of course that tragic mid-air collision over the Potomac River earlier this year. So a lot of people have questions about the safety of American aviation, and that's what we're going to talk about this hour with a couple of really great guests who understand this industry. Our questions for you: are you worried about flying? What do you think about our outdated air traffic control system? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, or if you're on YouTube, drop a comment right there in the chat.
Yeah, one thing that a lot of people have been talking about is the staffing shortages. So few air traffic controllers. It's a big effort to recruit them. So we have a lot of questions, and we would love to hear from you. And by the way, it's Thursday.
Oh, my God. I forgot to check my calendar. It's Thursday?
It's Thursday, pretty big day on the show. Hello.
That means we want your DJ of the Day submission. Mm-hmm. So pick a song related to our main theme, and producer Paige, Double P, will pick a winner to play as the closing music of the show. So email your suggestions to studio2@whyy.org by 12:30. Yeah. Don't be late.
Don't be late. And think skies, air, flying, so many things. And I think there's quite a few songs that relate to the theme.
About flying?
Yeah, of course. Oh, yeah.
This is an easy one. So
I have a couple that just popped into my head, and I'm not even that good at this. So I'm like, boom, boom, boom. So this
First
is
of
a good
all,
one.
I won't accept you bad mouthing yourself on this show.
So, by the way, we have something special.
Yeah.
Every email we get this week makes you eligible to win two tickets to an upcoming show in the Concerts Under the Stars series in King of Prussia.
We're giving away tickets to the Tom Petty versus Bruce Springsteen tribute band, Born to Run Down the Dream.
Okay.
It's a tribute band for the concept of Tom Petty versus Bruce Springsteen.
So they go back and forth.
But what's the verses part of it?
That's what I'm thinking. You remember verses on Instagram?
Is it a tribute
during
to,
the pandemic?
Is it a tribute to both artists, or is it a battle?
I don't know.
Well, you can find out Friday, June 6th at 7 p.m. The tickets are valued at $55 a pair. Four winners chosen today at random from everyone who emailed us comments. Okay.
Yay.
So if you want to find out what the heck this is, you can for free.
And there's benefits to participating in the conversation. By the way, yesterday, WHYY held his big awards, Lifelong Learning Awards, and I met a listener named Jack at the awards who listens to the show but never comments, never, you know, calls in.
Jack.
And I was like, Jack, nervous. And I said, Jack, it's me and Avi. You know
what?
Pick
up that phone, baby.
Pick up the phone. Chime in. So hopefully, you
Jack
know.
Jack Attack.
Just, you know, participate in the conversation. This conversation is much richer when we hear.
If I don't
from
hear from
all.
Jack in the next week.
Yeah.
I'll give him 2 weeks. I'll be disappointed.
Yeah. I feel like Jack is going to, you know, call in or email in. Again, that email studio2@whyy.org. And the number is 888-477-9499, just in case.
Something else I'm disappointed in, Philadelphia's lack of population growth.
I know, that's
Cherry.
A trio
so
of news
let's
stories.
Transition to the trio. Go
but
ahead.
I actually have some good news. I mean, Philly is still the nation's sixth largest city. The bad news is we're holding on to that title, but only by a very thin margin. The nation's seventh largest city is San Antonio, down in Texas. They are nipping at our heels, okay? Philly's population stands at 1,573,000 plus residents. San Antonio's is 1,526,000 plus residents. There's less than a 50,000 resident difference between the two cities.
Oh, boy.
And the problem is that in the past year, San Antonio grew by 24,000 people compared to Philly's growth of just 10,000 people.
Sounds like they're growing faster than
us,
Cherry.
They're growing a lot faster than us. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And get this, compared to other large cities, Philly's growth is anemic and below the national average of 1% population growth a year.
Let's cut to the chase here. San Antonio is going to pass us.
They're going to pass us in pretty soon, whether it's
gonna
be next
happen.
Year
We're going
or
from
the
six
year
to
after.
Seven. We yeah. already went from five to six.
Yeah, our last demotion.
Phoenix just passed us.
5 years ago. That was in 2020.
Yeah.
And the thing is, Philadelphia, we still are, we're still below our pre-pandemic population.
Yeah.
You
Not
know,
to mention where we were in the mid-20th
oh
century.
Oh, my goodness.
Around 2 million people.
I mean, and by the way, New York City has held the title for number one largest city in America since 1790.
Good for
We
them.
Were number two back then.
Yeah.
Okay. Then we fell to number three. Chicago bested us in 1890. We fell to fourth in 1960. And then in 1990, we held on to the fifth for like 30 years. And now we're six and we're holding on by a thread.
Producer Paige wants us to move along, so I'm going to move along to story number two. I had a lot more to say about that, by the way. Just letting everyone know.
So much.
Okay, story number two. We're going to talk about Newark Airport and the trouble in the skies, but there's also trouble on the rails in New Jersey.
Yeah.
We have reached the 11th hour in a labor dispute that could shut down NJ Transit trains across the Garden State as soon as tomorrow, and that is if NJ Transit cannot come to an agreement with the union that represents train engineer. So if that happens, look, the buses would still run, but the trains would be shut down. A lot of those riders who would have been on the trains will be on the buses. NJ Transit says in a contingency plan, they would charter some more buses, but it's going to be a mess if indeed these two sides cannot come to an agreement. The strange wrinkle here is that these two sides actually did come to an agreement in March on a new labor deal, but the union members voted that deal down.
Goodness, yeah.
And so since then, It's been at an impasse. NJ Transit, you know, this is typical, says they just can't afford what the engineers are asking for.
Yeah, they want, of course, it's always about money. And then the question is, who's going to pay for it? If you remember, New Jersey Transit just raised fares about 15% less than a year ago. There's another 3% hike coming up in a couple months. I mean, so the question is, how can they afford this? Yeah, but folks are going to have to work from home. There's a lot of people riding back and forth from New Jersey to New York, and so it's going to be a mess.
Yeah, the train part
could
of
be
it,
a mess.
The train part of the system is concentrated in the central and northern parts of the
yeah.
state, not as much in our region, but of course, this is going to impact the bus system. The bus system is all over the place. The NJ Transit buses, you see them here,
yeah, all
right
the
outside
time.
Our offices,
yeah.
right? So that's going to have a ripple effect through the whole system. Story number three.
Yes.
Cherry, cheer us up.
Yeah. That's a big order. Okay. So Philly is jumping on the bandwagon for a trend where people make fake food art.
Fake
yes.
food art.
This is an article from Philly Mag. It's titled, "What the hell is going on with this fake shrimp trend?" And,
can
and
we
the
say
title,
that?
Yeah, we could say hell. Yeah,
oh,
we could
say that.
And it's, you know, it's radio. And it made me chuckle. So apparently, there are classes where people make fake foods retro style. Like, think shrimp cocktail, you know, faux ice cream sundaes or banana splits. And, you know, you can imagine like a glass with fake ice cubes, huge fake plastic shrimp, right? Or wax shrimp.
I'm trying to imagine.
Yeah,
it.
Imagine this. This trend started in Japan, Avi, and they did it originally because, you know, you can't, if you go to a restaurant, you have the fake food to show people what they're going to eat. You can't put real food out there because bugs would come and it gets soggy looking and nasty looking. So people would do this fake art. And then people started taking the fake food art home, you know, as a little keepsake. And then it just kind of spread. And now we have classes here.
Fascinating history.
In Philadelphia.
So
would you do it? Make some fake food.
Cherry, did you ever think about, like, if you were sent to hell?
Oh, goodness.
And they designed a specific torture.
This would be it for you?
For your eternity.
Mm-hmm.
This would be my torture. A, I'm not a crafter.
Okay.
Okay, so let's start there.
I would figure that you would not be into crafts.
Just imagine, you're meticulously trying to make something,
mm-hmm.
all of this labor going into making something look as good as possible, but then you can't eat it.
And I know you're a foodie,
it's
so
like,
this would be bad.
It's like you're working to tempt yourself. It's like something they would design for Sisyphus.
Because you want it to look very juicy and delicious.
But then you can't eat it. There's mm-hmm. there's no payoff.
Could break a
There's
tooth.
No culinary payoff. This mm-hmm. seems insane, but no judgment if people enjoy doing this. I don't judge them at all. It's just, it is the opposite of for me.
Yeah. The opposite of for you. Yeah. I would do it. Maybe
really?
Once. Yeah. I don't know what I would make.
But it's so much time. Maybe a fake fruit bowl. So much attention. And then what do you get?
A fake fruit bowl.
A fake fruit bowl.
You can put it on an end table or, you know, on the kitchen
counter.
Would you
make one for me?
As a gift?
Yeah.
maybe.
And then maybe if I like that, I'll tiptoe into the real thing. Okay.
Well, we're cheered up. But now we're going to get serious.
Yep. We're going to talk about flying in the next segment. Stick with us on Studio 2. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. After a stretch of relative calm in the skies, 2025 has been a bad year for American aviation. In January, a mid-air collision over the Potomac River killed 67 people. And over the last few weeks, a series of tech outages created chaos at Newark Liberty International Airport.
We will discuss the details of the Newark mess in a moment, but first let me introduce our main guest this hour. Amy Wilder is a journalist at Aviation International News and also a pilot. Amy, thanks for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me, Avi and Cherry.
Yes. And for our listeners at home, listening online, are you worried about flying? That's our question of the day. And what do you think about our outdated air traffic control systems? We want to hear from you. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your questions or comments in the live chat.
So, Amy, we have to go back through the timeline of what's been happening up in Newark. So in April, late April, there is this telecommunications breakdown. Give us a sense of what happened there and what has happened subsequently.
Yeah. So there's a lot going on in the background. You mentioned earlier that there's aging infrastructure nationwide for air traffic control. And that is at the top of Transportation Secretary Duffy's list of things to fix, of course. On April 28th, there was a radar and communications outage that lasted about 30 to 90 seconds. Mm. And then there was another one again on May 9th, which have been confirmed by the FAA. This was at the Philadelphia Terminal Radar Approach Control. So there's different layers of ATC, but basically this is the center that's in charge of guiding airplanes in and out of the really busy airspace that's around Newark Airport, kind of in the New York City area, where traffic, you know, there's a lot of airplanes coming out of the airport and being routed in to land as well.
And remind folks, why is that facility in Philadelphia? Mm-hmm. And is that standard for those people to not be all that close to the place where the planes are?
Yeah. So I could give you just kind of an overview of how airspace in the U.S. works and how ATC works to kind of give you a visual sure. understanding yeah. of that. And then I can kind of speak a little bit more specifically about Philadelphia. So basically, if you think about the United States and you think about invisible cake layers above the ground, that's what our airspace kind of looks like. And the higher up in those layers you get as a pilot, the more you are talking to ATC and the more rules that you're following in general. I'm way oversimplifying
this.
That's
fine. That's fine. Go ahead.
Now, as you get closer to big cities, just like when you're driving toward a big city on the ground, the traffic gets a little more complicated. You know, there's people trying to come in, come out. Things are moving pretty quickly. And instead of stoplights and signs and overpasses and things like that, you have controllers telling you what to do. So there's different layers of air traffic control that sort of correlate with the different layers of airspace in the United States. You have regional centers who are helping traffic that's kind of transiting across the country. And then you have the TRACON, the Terminal Radar Approach Control Centers, that are helping guide traffic into the really busy airspace around cities. And then as they guide those in, they switch them off to the local towers at those airports. And then once airplanes are on the ground, they actually work with a different controller. So as an airplane is approaching a city, they're talking to three or four different layers of ATC. About a year ago, I think July 2024, the New York TRACON employees were moved over to the Philadelphia TRACON. And if I'm understanding correctly, I think that's because of short staffing
Yeah.
issues.
So
And then on
they're,
April, oh,
so
go ahead.
just to clarify, they're communicating with planes that are approaching Newark, but actually not at the lowest, most local level at Newark.
Correct. Yeah. As airplanes get closer to the ground and closer to the airport that they're headed to, they get handed off to the actual tower
Got it.
at that airport. So they're not talking to Philadelphia all the way down. They're kind of talking as they enter the airspace. But that is a critical,
Moment, yeah.
phase in the flight,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah, and one of the things we've heard a lot about is staffing for air traffic control. Can you tell us what staffing typically looks like and then what you know about what was happening at Newark?
Yeah, so I know currently, and I basically can speak to what I know. I know for decades, the FAA has been screaming for more controllers. We just don't have enough. These people keep us safe every day, and what they're doing with outdated technology and short staffing is frankly miraculous. They've been keeping us safe in the US for decades without, proper resources. And so right now, one of Duffy's initiatives is to hire a whole lot of air traffic controllers, but it takes time to train those people and to give them the experience that they need to to be up to speed. So right now at the Philadelphia TRACON, they have 27 controllers on duty, five of whom are supervisors, I believe, and then they have 21 people in training. And so almost double the number of people, the veteran controllers they're trying to train to bolster those numbers. So, that in itself is kind of a stressful workload too, I would imagine.
Yeah. And my follow-up to you is, can you tell us a little bit about Newark Airport? I know you cover national aviation news, but I'm just trying to get a sense of how busy this airport is and how many planes come in and out because people, they're more familiar with their individual airports, but people have no idea really how many flights go in and out of different airports across the country. And I understand that number is pretty high.
I think it's something like 40,000 flights a day across the US. I can't speak to specific numbers at Newark, but I can tell you that it is kind of, I said around cities, the airspace gets a little more complicated. It's almost like an upside down birthday cake close to big airports around cities. And the birthday cake around Newark kind of overlaps with LaGuardia and
JFK,
other
yeah.
really busy New York airports. So there's kind of like three huge airports in this shared, really busy airspace. And I mean, think about, how many international and national flights fly in and out of those airports a day. It's incredible. And I think some of the airlines are being proactive about reducing some of their flights until, they're sure that this is resolved. I think I saw a statement that United is reducing some of their flights in and out of Newark, which is pretty
And
significant.
that's their hub, yeah.
So the question, of course, all this leads to is what happened? So you've described it well, right? There's this layer of communication that happens with the facility in Philadelphia as people are coming into Newark, not when they're quite there, but as they're making that approach. And we know at least twice now the communication between this facility in Philadelphia and those flights, those planes failed. What do we know about why?
Yeah, I mean, we still don't know a whole lot of details. We know that on April 28th, the controllers in the tower lost radar and radio communication for somewhere between 30 and 90 seconds, which, when you have airplanes coming into that busy airspace is an eternity. A lot happens in that time period. There were some communications lines that failed, and I believe there was a backup that may have failed as well. And then on May 9th at almost 4 a.m., I think it was 3:55 a.m. local time, the tower or the TRACON, excuse me, not the tower, lost communications again during that time period. So the Department of Transportation and the FAA have a task force who are working on setting up three high bandwidth feeds to replace the aging lines. They're also deploying a temporary backup system to replace that.
Yeah.
So,
I do have a question about this because we've heard this discussion of a copper wire that failed. I want you to talk about the system a little bit, because that sort of sounds scary to me. We're in 2025, we're using copper wires, we've heard about floppy disks. Can you talk about this, and how old are these systems?
Yeah, these systems are decades old, and this was actually a surprise to me going through pilot training, because you know, you don't have a lot of visibility on what it actually looks like in an air traffic control tower as a layperson or even as a pilot, really. But yeah, they're using computers that are decades old. I mean, you think like bad sci-fi movie from the 70s. Mm. That's the kind of equipment that you Gosh. Might see in one Gosh. Of those towers.
Yeah.
So, and I want to play. It's definitely in need of upgrading.
Yeah, I want to play this clip. The Trump administration has proposed a multi-billion-dollar overhaul of a U.S. air traffic control system last week. And here is Secretary Duffy talking about the outdated technology at that press conference. Take a listen.
Do you know where we go? eBay. We shop on eBay to replace parts to fix our equipment in the system that keeps you safe, keeps your family safe. And to Nick's point, that is 100% unacceptable, especially for the greatest country that's ever existed on the face of the earth. We deserve better than that.
Okay, so we're hearing now about the possibility, perhaps the imminence, mm-hmm. of some sort of overhaul here. Amy, what do we know about what the administration is proposing, and what, crucially, don't we know yet?
Well, we don't know how it's going to work or what exactly it's going to look like at this point. What we do know is this may be the one thing that all Americans can agree on right now. This system needs an upgrade. And I think Congress is on board with that across party lines. President Trump is online with that. Secretary Duffy is just, you know, getting the message out as quick as he can. And so he has a $12 billion proposal on the table to, they're already working on hiring initiatives for mm-hmm. Controller staff. That's, you know, item number one. And then, you know, they're working to upgrade the computer infrastructure and even things like the communications infrastructure, the lines, the telecommunication lines, instead of those copper wires, which, you know, actually Duffy's comments were news to me. I did not know that they were copper wires until I saw that briefing.
Wow. Mm. And I think about this because I know they have all these plans and to move forward, but I wonder, how did we get here in the first place? And I think about this because so many of us fly, and you just trust it blindly, and you would think that we would be making investments. How has this occurred?
That's a great question. I think there are a lot of economic forces at work here. You know, it's just, how do you make room in the budget for huge upgrades? And I love that you mentioned trust, Cherry, because the aviation industry, the heart of the aviation industry is trust. Pilots and controllers and mechanics have an incredibly high level of integrity. And part of the reason that we haven't seen more accidents over the years is because of that high level of training and integrity and dedication. There's no cutting corners, you know, on the training side and on the work ethic side. However, at some point, you know, you reach critical mass with an aging infrastructure, and yeah, it costs an incredible amount of money. It's mind-boggling how much money it costs to upgrade that. But, you know, on the one hand, you've got controllers who are reaching retirement age, and a lot of them have the institutional knowledge to understand how that older technology works. And so as younger controllers come in, you know, and Duffy touched on an interesting point. I had no idea we were getting replacement parts from eBay. But on the other hand, of course we are, because these computers are so old, they're not manufacturing, you know, replacement parts for them. So what else are you going to do unless you completely upgrade the system?
So you are listening there to Amy Wilder, who's a journalist at Aviation International News and a pilot. We're going to go to a break now here on Studio 2, but on the other side of this break, we're going to keep Amy, but also bring in a former air traffic controller who can tell us a little bit more in detail about what that job entails. So keep your comments coming, studio2@whyy.org. You can call 888-477-9499. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment in the live chat. We'll be right back.
A lot to talk about.
Yep, I hear you just fine.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. This hour, we are discussing America's aviation safety system with a focus on the evolving issues up in Newark. We've been talking with Amy Wilder, journalist at Aviation International News. She's also a pilot. Before we bring in our next guest, let me read a few comments from you. Lydia says, not flying anytime soon. Something is not right all of a sudden. Valentine says, I'm a retired military who hasn't flown since Christmas 1999. 9/11 was bad enough, but this administration is a clear and present danger to reality. Aaliyah says, in his first term, Trump voted against funding for updated equipment and further pay training for those that man these important positions. This term, he has done the same and fired folks. This is the result.
Yeah. And so joining us now is Todd Yeary. He is a former air traffic controller. Todd, welcome to Studio 2.
Jerry, good to be with you. Good to see you, Avi.
Yeah. Good to see you too, Todd.
So Todd, so many questions for you. I mean, we want to really understand this job of traffic controller. And we know that you spent years working in that control tower. So give us a true understanding of what it is that air traffic controllers do day to day and the pressures that you face.
Well, it's a great question. First, I worked at Chicago Air Traffic Control Center, which is a regional center. It actually handles airplanes between airports. So the phase of flight between takeoff and landing and beginning to line up or at least sequence the airplanes going into the airports is what we would do. We also controlled smaller airport airspace. Some of them don't have towers, and so we would provide air traffic control services from what we would say the ground up, and then some of the smaller approach controls. We would run the airspace overnight to be able to manage traffic and actually staffing more effectively or efficiently, if you will. But here's what goes on in a typical day. Let's take today, for example. Air traffic control, for the most part, in terms of the traffic flows, is somewhat predictable. Right. Mm-hmm. The schedules of airlines are pretty consistent. They tend to be the larger users, some of them passengers, some of them cargo. You do get private pilots. I understand Amy is a pilot. And so we get those services as well. But what happens is the unpredictable. Weather pops up. You'll get pop up thunderstorms in the afternoon and in the late spring and throughout the summer. And so what starts as an otherwise predictable day can become rather chaotic in a short amount of time and without much notice, if you get any notice at all. And so it requires a great deal of anticipation, but also preparation. And so equipment outages add to the complexity. They were not uncommon when I was controlling, but we also understood that there were procedures in place. You have pilots who are well-trained, you have controllers who are well-trained, and they know how to respond in the event that some issues come up that require patience more than anything else while the technical folks address those concerns. So all of that just kind of says every day is a new day, predictable at the start, but you never know how it's going
to
end up.
And my follow-up to you is this. I mean, I think about that 30 to 90 second outage that those air traffic controllers experience while dealing with Newark Liberty International. Imagine that for us. Help us imagine what it was like during those 30 to 90 seconds, what you would be dealing with if that were you in the tower.
So a couple of things. Airspace connects with other airspace, facilities with other facilities. And so if one facility has an outage, there are other facilities that are able to buffer that outage. I would imagine that if the TRACON, Philadelphia TRACON, lining up for Newark lost radar, there would immediately be some conversation with someone at the center, whether that's Washington Center or New York Center, about taking over that airspace or beginning to look for the airplanes that they cannot now see. The other part is that the arriving traffic, if they're on a published instrument approach, there are things that you can begin to instruct the pilots to do without necessarily needing to see where the airplanes are. So if you have tracked them effectively leading up to the outage, you should be able to maneuver effectively. There was one FedEx flight that I believe was on what we call a radar vector. He was on a heading that got close to LaGuardia's airspace, but that's why you would have coordination with other facilities to make sure that you had all eyes watching on what's going on in the airspace.
So that redundancy is baked into the system. So there is a protocol when something like this happens, even though it happens rarely.
Every facility has a book of what we call letters of agreement, right? It's really the contingency plan for when things go awry. And they will sometimes go awry, but it helps everybody to know that when things do happen, then we do what we call stick to the plan. And I believe that is one of the reasons why you were able to hear that though there were some proximity issues with other airspace, you did not hear any loss of safety margin with any of the airplanes.
Some of these air traffic controllers who had to deal with that day have taken trauma leave. Can you talk about some of the pressures that air traffic controllers face? Also, we've heard about staffing issues as well, and people doing the job of like multiple people.
Yeah, so that's a situation by situation scenario in an individual facility. But let's talk about the trauma. The staffing issues have created this ongoing pressure where many controllers are working 6 days mandatory overtime, very little break. And so those things that come up that normally would be a bit more routine than we might think, let's say you have a temporary outage of radio, not uncommon, sometimes a glitch. This was when the computer was being brought back up after running some tests. Those things are not uncommon, but when you've got the ongoing and persistent pressure of being overworked and not as rested, then of course the margin for trauma gets much tighter. And so I think we're beginning to see the cracks in the pavement, if you will, that an overworked air traffic control workforce needs to have some relief and some good equipment that is reliable at the same time. That's what I sense is going on. We didn't have, trauma leave was usually tied to aircraft accidents or close calls when I was working. Very rarely did we have to take trauma leave for a temporary radar or radio outage. But when you add all of the ingredients in this case, in this cake rather, you've got the butter that's a little slippery with staffing. You've got the eggs where you don't have the equipment. The problem is we don't have enough flour to get this thing baked. And so that's where the government has to come in.
You mentioned in your answer that some types of radio outages are actually not uncommon. Maybe help us understand what differentiates what happened or what has happened at Newark with the more common types of glitches. Like, put these into categories for me.
I'm not saying that this was even an uncommon glitch. Mm-hmm. So if I were to lose radio contact, every aircraft has a setup for the emergency frequency. So if I lose regular frequencies, I have the ability to do a mass broadcast if the emergency frequency is still available, to be able to make an open call. It's like the announcements in school at the end of the day, right, where the principal's talking to everybody at the same time. And so the redundancies that you mentioned are there. I think the challenge is the uncertainty is so great now that there's a great deal of pause and hesitation amongst the controller workforce about whether or not the equipment is going to sustain them through much less the shift, but actually through the next segment of whatever the ebb and flow of that day might be. That's the bigger concern that we have to address.
So how bad, I mean, I know you spent years there, but how bad has the equipment been? And we had Amy try to describe this and was actually surprised to hear that, you know, copper wire was involved and that people are getting stuff from eBay. From your perspective, someone who was inside the tower, how bad is it?
So inside the control room, the short answer is it depends, right? The busier airports, busier facilities get some of the attention earlier. But when you're installing new equipment, you do not start with the most complex facilities in airspace. You have to have time to be able to test it to find out if there are any bugs. Every implementation of new equipment has its challenges, right? But I'll give you a comparison. My father was one of the PATCO controllers fired in 1981. We used to go to work with him on days to kind of see what it was like and touch the equipment. When I started working years later as one of the cohorts, a member of one of the cohorts to backfill for the controllers that were fired, the computer equipment that I was working on or working with as an adult was the same equipment that I remember touching as a kid. Wow. And so it took a number of years, actually about another decade after that, before we started to see new equipment coming in, because government procurement is often a bit cumbersome. And it is often very political. That's the bigger concern. Mm-hmm. How are we not going to kick this thing down the road and just play another game of got you? It is not a thing where the flying public flies according to which party's in power, or whether or not they're going to allow you to board the plane depending on your party affiliation or if you're a registered voter. Everybody relies on this system. And so we need all hands on deck and a full commitment from Congress and the executive to make sure that this gets implemented. 3 years is a bit ambitious, so you're going to have a long-term commitment to see this thing all the way through.
If you want to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. Let me bring in a caller now. This is Dan from Queen Village. Dan, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I was actually curious about the politics of it all, because, you know, Trump is blaming the problems on Biden, but it's been going on for decades. So, you know, how political is it? Is my question.
That's the question from Dan, Queen Village. You were kind of already, Todd, you were starting to address that. It does seem like the lack of investment transcends administration, transcends party. Mm-hmm. Is that about right?
It does. I mean, if we go back, Ronald Reagan, the candidate, supported the controllers. Ronald Reagan, the president, fired them. And then you had successive administrations, 8 years with Reagan, 8 years with Clinton, 8 years with Reagan, 8 years with Bush, 41, 8 years with Clinton. And then you had Bush, 43. Then you've got Barack Obama. And then you have one Trump administration, the Biden administration, the Trump administration. It really is which administration is going to make sure they do their part with the time that they have to move the needle on this thing. The problem is when we start having fights over appropriations and who's going to get cuts and consideration, at the end of the day, it's not so much who's taking the credit. Everybody's taking the blame in this because nothing's getting done.
And so the question for you, Amy Wilder, want to bring you back into the conversation. You know, the Trump administration is has cut the federal government, right? Is very keen on cutting government spending. And yet Secretary Duffy is saying that this is going to cost billions and billions. Can you talk about the political will here from that we're seeing so far from the Trump administration to get this thing done?
Yeah, I will say that it shouldn't have taken a very public accident to get us here. I think that's a tragedy. And but I do see agreement across political lines right now. I think different members of Congress are on board, Republicans, Democrats. Now, like I said, we don't know what the solution is going to actually look like. And I think when you get down to the discussions in Congress, you know, who knows what's actually going to happen and how it's going to play out. It's a lot of really forward-looking, ambitious talk right now. So, you know, I would love for Duffy to get his $12 billion and overhaul everything. But I think Todd pointed to something that's really critical, which is, you know, in spite of its aging infrastructure, the current system that we have does work. It's limping along. But when you start to overhaul an entire national system, as Todd pointed out, you're risking bugs and yep. problems that you haven't foreseen just because it hasn't been done yet. So I think it has to be done thoughtfully, carefully, you know, to keep everybody safe.
I wanted to ask about how this should be undertaken, if indeed it is undertaken. Should we approach this as let's keep the basic system in place, but just sort of update it? Or should there be a rearrangement of how the system works? And let me read this quote from Robert Poole of the Reason Foundation, who wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. He said, a single digital remote tower can manage many smaller control towers at lower cost and higher productivity. These systems are expanding throughout Europe. The FAA has resisted this breakthrough innovation, suggesting that perhaps there's just a way to do this better instead of taking sort of the current infrastructure and, you know, raising its level. What do you think about that, Todd Geary?
Well, I think it's an interesting point of view. We've had conversations about levels of privatization of the air traffic control system for a while.
Yep.
The reality is that less than 1% or so of the air traffic control systems of the world are actually privatized. So that's number one. Digitally controlling, you can't really run an AI-based almost system remote. This is not fly-by-wire. One, because you've got to respond to dynamic conditions that may not be programmed into whatever that function is, such as weather, such as we have to evacuate the control tower because there's a tornado on the field. And so now we've got to shut down everything, including pushing back the entire system until things work. Let me give you a case in point. You mentioned it, Avi, a little bit earlier. I was working on 9/11. I remember how immediately we had to clear the airspace, and the requirement was we were forcing airplanes to land at airports that were not on their flight plan, and if they refused, they were getting military escorts. And so because there is a defense dynamic, there is a national safety component to it, we got to be careful with how much of this gets contracted out. This is not just an economic equation. It goes to the fundamentals of how the nation even functions. And quite honestly, if we look at the law, if Congress were to formally declare war, which is their power, as opposed to police actions, which are a little different with the executive, if there's a formal declaration of war, the function of air traffic control converts to the military. And so we got to consider these dynamics about how our system works differently than other countries, because our system is more complex. The reliance on our system globally is more intense. And the functions, if there should be a national emergency, are a bit more unique than what we see in other places.
So to summarize, it is hard to algorithmically design something that could account for all of the variables, you think, that are at play in the American airspace and in just the way the American government is structured. Is that kind of the idea here?
Yeah, I don't think we want to go to kind of a weather service forecasting anticipation. The changes, equipment changes, Amy's a pilot. Sometimes things change in the dynamic just with issues that might be mechanical and beyond the reach of air traffic control that changes the dynamic, right? We saw it in Philadelphia, actually, a few days after the Reagan crash, when the medevac plane took off and immediately went into a nosedive. That changes the dynamic. That's not part of the script, and you don't write that into an algorithm.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, because the whole design and the technological aspect of the air traffic control system is one thing, but then I want to get back to the people aspect, because the New York Times had reported that as few as three air traffic controllers were working at Newark Liberty International Airport on a recent Monday evening, and that was 11 fewer than the targeted number for that time period. And so, Todd Geary, my question for you is, like, how do you recruit? Like, clearly, they got three people working, 11 fewer than what was necessary on a Monday when you have all these flights going in and out. What is going to be needed to really recruit the type of people that you need to get staffing levels to something that is much more reasonable?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. One, we have to make sure that how we are giving the narration is accurate. So there may have been three people on position. I'm not sure that they're saying there were only three people at that time on a ship, right? Because there is a need for some ebb and flow with how you use your available controllers. I spent a couple of details as a supervisor, so I know how sectors are combined and then reopened. We know how to maneuver around those things. So I would need a little more information before I comment on that. But here's what I would say. We know there's a shortfall. Right. Here's how we know. Ronald Reagan fired 11,000 controllers. Then you had to hire 11,000 more. Right. You then had increasing demand on the system where it was much busier over the years. And then you had 9/11, the disruption, where we had a period of extended reduction in use of the system, and now it's coming back. A little disruption with COVID, now it's coming back. You've got attrition. So you have a mandatory retirement age of 56. You cannot control live traffic after the last day of the month you turn 56 years old. So we ought to be able to know what is going to be our potential loss for, let's say, the next 5 to 10 years, and do that analysis to understand how do we get a one-to-one just to be able to manage actual attrition. And then you got to figure out how you're going to close the gap. You cannot lose a seasoned controller one day and replace them with a new hire the next day. When I arrived at Chicago Center in May of my first year, by the time I was fully certified as controller, it was 3.5 years later. It's not overnight.
Mm. We've talked so much about the controller side of this, Amy Wilder, but you know, on the pilot side, what types of pressure are folks in that occupation facing right now? Because obviously, look, it's two-way communication. It's controller to pilot and back. What types of pressures are pilots facing right now? What's the state of that industry?
Yeah. So I'm a private pilot. I fly very small airplanes. Think like Toyota Corolla of the sky, basically. So I personally don't spend a lot of time in the really busy airspace, but some of the services I might access through ATC are what's called flight following, which is at a control center like where Todd worked previously. So Chicago Center controls a huge area. My airspace falls under Kansas City Center, which controls most of Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, parts of Illinois. And basically, you know, you call in as a pilot. If I'm flying visual flight rules rather than instrument flight rules, I request those services and say, and basically the agreement is they kind of give me information as I'm flying and they help keep me separated from other airplanes in the air. You're moving really fast. And when you're looking for other airplanes, you can see them maybe a mile, maybe 2 miles at a stretch away from you. And when you're flying, you know, even little airplanes fly at 140 miles an hour in the air. So you don't have a lot of time to react. So, you know, talking to air traffic control can give you information about changing weather conditions, other traffic in the area is really critical. But sometimes those centers get overloaded. And when you're, in a small aircraft, when they have a high workload on the commercial side of things, they have unexpected things happen like weather, like Todd mentioned, a lot of people flying into a particular area, they might cancel your services and say, you know, we don't have the controllers to help you at this point. And, you know, you aren't legally required necessarily to have those services, but it's an extra layer of safety in the air. So now flying into a bigger airport on a commercial flight, you have a really intensive workload. Those professional pilots are doing, you know, they're controlling the operation of the airplane, which gets a lot more stressful as you approach an airport. You're talking to, like I described before, there's different layers of air traffic control and they hand you off to different layers as you approach the airport and then land on the ground. And so, you know, you're also switching between radio channels. Like Todd mentioned, you also always have the emergency channel open for those blanket, announcements if you need them. So there is a lot going on. You think about like the most, I'm trying to think of a really intense mental activity, like the most intense game of chess you've ever played mixed with like playing basketball at the same time.
It's a lot. Yeah.
You know, it's a big workload. So, air traffic controllers are really incredible. They get stressed out, but they really do. Keep people safe.
And we have to wrap up. And so I just want to, Todd, I think about this. We've talked about this attention on the issue of air traffic control. In 30 seconds, can you tell me, do you see this as a good thing? And do you think all the fixes that need to get done will get done?
Well, I think it's a good thing, but it's not the first time we've had a good thing, right? We've come away with bad disappointment before. The real issue is who's going to be in charge of the project and who are they going to be listening to for the phases of implementation if you don't have subject matter expertise. Then this just becomes another political hot potato, and we'll be back here again having this conversation in the near future.
Hopefully not. That is Todd Yeary, former air traffic controller. Thank you so much for your time. And Amy Wilder, journalist at Aviation International News and a pilot. Thanks to you as well, Amy and Todd. Great insight this hour.
And by the way, our DJ of the day has been announced.
You're hearing it right now.
Kevin is the DJ of the day, and it's a classic
just
80s.
Kevin?
Yeah.
Just Kevin. All right,
just Kevin. And it's a classic 80s banger from the movie Top Gun, Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins. Let's take a listen.
You know this song.
I do.
And Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is a different Kevin, Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio GM from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg.